Welcome back. You're listening to The Keepers, archiving the now. A new special from the Kitchen Sisters and PRX. Stories of can-do people, must-do people, get-it-done people. People who are grappling with the now. I'm your host, Frances McDormand. We begin in March 2020 in a massive warehouse by the Oakland Airport.
This is the sewing area.
It's my area. They call Gertland. If you know me, I mean, it screams Gert.
I used to work in the theater, so I've got a lot of theatrical type stuff. That's a foxy lady mannequin. I'd dress them up and stuff.
Disco balls.
There's ashes in that big one there. A friend of mine who died, and we had a little party for him. This is Connie. This is a sewing machine that's done the quilt since day one. Cleve and I call this our graveyard because they're the sewing machines that sewed the quilt. I probably have about 50 of them. These are my favorite. They kind of look like old Chevys. My name is Gert McMullen. We are at the warehouse and sewing area for the NAMES Project AIDS Memorial Quilt, right across from the Oakland Airport. It's been here since January.
Gert McMullen was one of the first San Franciscans to put a stitch on the AIDS quilt in the 1980s, the massive community quilt that began with one memorial square in honor of a man who died of AIDS, a quilt that now holds more than 95,000 names. Gert, a girl who taught herself to sew after her mother died when she was 9, never planned it this way. But over the decades, she has become the keeper of the quilt and has stitched it, tended it, repaired it, traveled with it, lived with it, and conserved it for some 33 years now.
My official title is quilt conservator, but I just call myself a sewer. But it was all Cleve Jones' idea. He doesn't sew, but he got us all to sew. He saved my life, his idea.
My name is Cleve Jones. I'm a San Franciscan. I've been an activist for many years, organizing gay and lesbian rights. The quilt, it was my idea, but Gert is the mother of the quilt.
So this is a quilt. It starts way down that way. The number one is up there, and then it starts going around this way. It's all numerical. It's kind of like a library. From number one all the way up to now, we have 5,992 12 by 12 times 8. So it's about 48,000 panels. It weighs about 60 tons. It would take up the whole National Mall and the whole Ellipse and go out to the street. There's about 95,000 names. These are my boys. That's what I call them, my boys.
When the coronavirus hit in February 2020, Gert was one of the first Bay Area citizens to begin sewing masks. PPE for nurses and healthcare workers who were lacking proper protection. Masks she makes from fabric left over from the making of the AIDS quilt. Gert knows the power of sewing. The Kitchen Sisters present Gert McMullen, Sewing the Front Line.
We don't have everything all together yet. We were actually really lucky to get all the quilt up on the shelves. We were really lucky. We got it here just in time, because as soon as we got here, then COVID-19 hit.
My name is John Cunningham, Executive Director of the National AIDS Memorial. After we went into isolation and into shelter at home, I received a call that our board member, Tom Jensen, had been diagnosed COVID positive. Gert was in tears, and yeah, Gert has done a lot of the sewing, but back in the day, in the darkest days of the epidemic, Gert also spent a lot of time in the wards at SF General, where the first nurses were treating AIDS patients, the first AIDS wards. Those boys were alone, because their parents had abandoned them oftentimes, their communities had abandoned them. Gert spent time in there with not only friends, but strangers.
I just started to freak out because we couldn't go visit him. And I'm not used to that. This disease is so different because with AIDS, we could take it out to the street. You know, Cleveland with his bullhorn, you know, and we could do something. Here we have to hide away. The government's not doing enough, and we can't even go out and tell them they're not doing enough. I heard something about nurses not getting the right equipment, and I thought, oh my God, you know, because the nurses were so great with AIDS, risking their lives, maybe there's something I can do.
She called me in the morning and she said, there aren't masks. I can sew.
We have a lot of fabric here that has been donated throughout the years to make panels from the AIDS Memorial quilt, and I started making masks. My mother used to make all kinds of clothes for me. She died when I was 9 and left 6 of us. So I took her sewing machine. I taught myself how to sew. My given name is Cindy McMullen, but I changed it to Gert in the mid-80s when the AIDS crisis was really getting bad.
My friends were the first to die. I was starting to lose my mind. Nobody would let me talk about people who had died, and I was really losing it.
My friends died, I made new friends, they died, I made new friends, they died. It just went on and on and on, year after year after year. The media was reducing it to statistics, and I wanted to condemn the government. I wanted something to lay out at the front of the White House and the Congress to say, look, you failed.
If this were a man and a woman holding hands, it would be considered perfectly natural. But these are men, and for men in this society to hold hands in public is at least shameful and more often offensive. They are homosexuals.
For my generation, there was no information that there were even other people like us. I thought I was the only one in the whole world. I was one of those kids who was planning on committing suicide, pilfering medications from my parents, getting ready to overdose. And then I read in Life magazine, the year in review, 1971, about the Stonewall Rebellion and the gay liberation movement. The movement saved my life. As soon as I graduated from high school, I got the hell out, hitchhiked to San Francisco, and it was a time of migration. The people we now call LGBTQ kids were leaving their hometowns and going to the big cities. The word was out that this culture was exploding. Gayborhoods emerging and political movement, an incredible club scene.
I moved to San Francisco in the early 80s.
Gert was a club kid, dancer.
I worked at Macy's Cologne and Cosmetics and Theater. You couldn't get hanging around more gay men than that.
It was a very romantic, dramatic time. I've met some of the great pioneers of what we now call the LGBTQ community. And of course, I met Harvey Milk. He was always hanging out, registering voters, passing out flyers on the corner of Castro and 18th in San Francisco. Took me under his wing and got me to cut my hair and stop selling pot and go to school. Probably the first adult to tell me that I had value just as I was, essentially bribed me with an internship. He said that he was going to get elected and I could go and work for him for credits.
Cleve was Harvey Milk's right-hand man. He was his wingman. As a gay man, I mean, Harvey Milk was the one who broke through.
First gay supervisor elected in San Francisco, his name is Harvey Milk. First of all, congratulations, and I've never seen anything like this, Harvey.
Oh, it's all over the city tonight.
Does that mean, as many straights are concerned, maybe the gays are taking over San Francisco? Are you going to be a supervisor for all the people?
I have to be. That's what I was elected for. I have to be there, too.
He was like this kind of odd Jewish guy from New York who came to San Francisco and just won the heart of that city. To watch him at the bus stops and the senior centers and the Union Hall, and he'd just walk up and he'd say, "Hi, I'm Harvey Milk, what's your name?" And he would find that common ground and he would build on that.
If I'm fighting for the rights of gay people, and I am, then I must fight for the rights of all people, you know, all the minorities, the senior citizens, the handicapped, the disenfranchised people, or I'm a hypocrite.
Another tragedy is upon us.
November 27th, 1978, that horrible day in City Hall.
The mayor of San Francisco was shot dead in his office in City Hall this morning.
Both Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk have been shot and killed.
Oh, Jesus Christ!
The... suspect is Supervisor Van White.
This is the body of Supervisor Harvey Milk as it was taken from City Hall.
I had been in his office that morning and I'd left a file and went back to get it. And when I got back, I found his body and, it was just so horrifying. And I thought, it's just over, it's over. And then the sun went down. And the people began to gather at the corner of Castro and Market, hundreds, then thousands, then tens of thousands, that river of candlelight down Castro Street to Civic Center Plaza. And I knew it was not over. It was just beginning.
I can remember after Harvey Milk and Mayor Moscone had been killed and Cleve stood on the steps of City Hall, he said, "We, the gay community, are a loving and gentle people. We will get through this, but we will also rise up."
So that winter, as Dan White's trial went on, it got very, very grim. Dan White basically got slapped on the wrist with a manslaughter conviction. And that night, May 21st, it was the most violent uprising in the history of the LGBT movement, the White Night Riot. Enormous property damage was done. Police cars were burned. And the city was paralyzed. It was only a couple years later that first Morbidity and Mortality Weekly report out of the Centers for Disease Control about HIV/AIDS.
My friends were the first to die. And then when it just started going, and all my friends, just everybody I knew was sick or dying, and nobody wanted to talk about it.
Federal health officials consider it an epidemic. Yet you rarely hear a thing about it.
It's a disease first detected in the gay community.
San Francisco and Los Angeles.
In 1985, in the Castro, just the Castro neighborhood, 10 blocks, 1,000 people had died. Almost everyone was caring for someone.
Mike Smith, co-founder of the Names Project Foundation, at the Smithsonian Folklife Festival, 2012.
Cleve Jones, who organizes the Candlelight March every year for George Moscone and Harvey Milk, was fed up with people not being public, staying in the shadows with so much stigma and phobia. And so he asked people who were going to march in the Candlelight March to make a simple sign with the name of someone they knew.
I was just so struck by that number, 1,000. And I remember standing at the corner of Castro and Market, beautiful Victorian homes and cafes and restaurants and clubs. You hear music and smell food and coffee and hear laughter. And you have no idea that you're standing at the epicenter of this really horrendous tragedy that at that time was rapidly spreading. That night, I had Harvey Milk's old bullhorn, and I got stacks of poster board, and I asked everybody to write the name of someone they knew who had been killed by the new disease. At first, people were ashamed to do it, but finally began writing their first and last names. We carried these placards to San Francisco City Hall, down to UN Plaza. We'd hidden ladders in the shrubbery nearby, climbed up the front gray stone facade of this building and taped the names to the wall. There were thousands of people. It was gentle rain, people reading these names on this patchwork of placards up on that wall, and I thought to myself, it looks like some kind of quilt. I thought of my grandma. My great-grandma back in Bee Ridge, Indiana, and the quilts they'd made. Warm and comforting and middle American traditional family values. And I thought, this is the symbol we should take.
You're listening to The Keepers, archiving the now. Back in a moment. Welcome back. I'm your host, Frances McDormand. You're listening to the saga of Gert McMullen.
We put up some signs around the Castro that said volunteers needed, come to a meeting. And Gert showed up with some friends and two panels that she'd already made.
What made me come into it is that all my friends were dying and I was losing my mind and I needed something to do. I always made presents for my friends, so it was another way of kind of making presents for them. Mike Smith ran the meeting and there were six people that showed up. Cleve didn't even go to the first meeting because he said he knew it was going to be a failure. Wrote my address on my first two panels because I thought, oh, you know, these queens, I don't know what they'll do with these panels. Nancy thought we were out of our mind. She's like, well, nobody's going to do that. What are you, crazy?
Let me just tell you this. A long time ago, 1987, Cleve Jones comes to my home. We want to take some pictures to announce the Names Project.
Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, at the Library of Congress, November 20th, 2019.
Now I am just newly elected, a member of Congress, and I say to Cleve, Cleve, a quilt? Nobody sews. I said I have five children. I went to school in a convent. I know how to sew. I know how to darn. I don't sew. So if I don't sew, with mother of five, with a sewing machine and all of that knowledge, Nobody sews. So I said, Cleve, I just don't know about this project. Can't we do something else? And he said, no, this is it. We're sticking with this.
Every day, these brown paper packages would arrive at our workshop at 2362 Market Street. I remember the first one that came in for a baby that had died of AIDS, and it had her stuffed animals. I remember one day Gert said, you better come look at this. That was the first panel that came in with the ashes of the person that was being remembered.
These are the very first ones. They used to be a lot thinner. They're kind of like your old pajamas that you don't want to throw away. They're your real favorite ones that don't fold very well, and they always kind of mess up the shelf, and that's what these are like. I call them the old soldiers. They're just beaten up a bit.
The first panels were done on sheets that were done with spray paint.
Some of the quilts were angry. Some of the quilts assailed Reagan. Roy Cohn, the evil fascist closet case that was part of the whole witch hunt against homosexuals, and he, who died of AIDS, who's the subject of Angels in America. This young man created a panel for him, and it said, bully, coward, victim.
I was angry. I wanted people to know that I loved this person and that they had died a horrible death. Nobody seemed to care. Cleve Jones wanted to bring it to Washington. It was really an activist move. We were pissed and we were going to throw our dead down in front of the White House. The panels are made 3 foot by 6 foot. That's the size of a grave.
Cleve says, we want to bring the quilt. Now it's almost 2,000 panels to Washington, D.C. Now I'm in Washington, and so he comes to me and he says, we want to display it on the Mall. We're getting some resistance. So I said, well, that can't be, right? So I go to see the National Park Service. They said, well, we can't do it because you're going to kill the grass. So well, we can handle that. We're not going to kill the grass. You're going to have to get the quilt lifted up every 20 minutes. And I said, well, you understand, we have volunteers from all over the country. That's the easiest thing in the world. We will lift up the quilt every 20 minutes.
Today, a quilt made by Americans across the country was unfurled. Each of the 2,000 panels bears the name of an AIDS victim.
Rico Draper.
Jim Bishop. Timothy LaPree. Al Alford.
Speaker after speaker called for more money and more research.
We must end the AIDS virus, the AIDS crisis, and stop death and give life a chance.
Randy Pruitt, John Davis, Johnny Weaver, Dong Laundry, Norman Hall, Catherine Wheeler.
In 1999, we were over on Townsend Street, near where the ballpark was going into. And, you know, when the dot-com thing came through and all the rents skyrocketed, and they wanted all that land. I mean, we were going under, frankly. I mean, monetarily, we were going under.
Commercial real estate was going through the roof in San Francisco, so it made sense to go to Atlanta, where there was less expensive office space, warehouse space.
The quilt, moved to Atlanta, and was there for 19 years. I followed it. I went to Atlanta. These are my boys. I had no choice. It wasn't a choice. I was just going to go with it, whether they wanted me to or not.
This is a woman who would sew all day, sew all night, and then she would climb up into the shelves with the fabric and fall asleep, and then get up and make coffee and start sewing again. It is Gert who has handled every single panel. It is Gert who decided which ones went in which square. It's Gert who has repaired them. It is Gert who has, you know, saved all of the archive. That's another thing. And I used to tell her, hey, why are you saving all this stuff? Letters, photographs, military medals, ashes, posters. Gert saved all of this.
I've been bitched at for many years. Why do you keep all this stuff? A lot of little teddy bears or little stuffed animals and stuff, they've fallen off the quilt and we don't know where they belong. They got so mad at me for keeping so many boxes of stuff that I finally brought it home, and then I had my own storage unit. I said, I'm not throwing it out. We used to have 20 huge fireproof file cabinets full of documentation that accompanied all of these panels. I would read them, file it, cross-reference it with the panel, and I know that somebody's going to want it.
And that archive has now been transferred to the custody of the Library of Congress.
Librarian of Congress, Dr. Carla Hayden.
Good morning. We are honored to announce that the National AIDS Memorial will become the new caretaker of the AIDS Memorial Quilt. And as part of the transition, the Library of Congress's American Folklife Center will become the new home for the National AIDS Memorial Quilt Archive Collection. It will help humanize and bring to mind the scale
this
of the AIDS pandemic through the words and
voices. This quilt is a family heirloom for the countless men and women who lost their lives and to those who love and remember them.
John Lewis, U.S. Representative from Georgia.
Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. often spoke of the beloved community, a society at peace with itself and its neighbors. From the earliest days of the AIDS crisis, this community provided for each other what society denied them. Brotherhood, sisterhood, human decency, and unconditional love.
The quilt came back to San Francisco in December. So Gert comes back, trucks pulling up.
It took 6 52-foot semis to get it here.
55 miles long, unfurled all at once. Has that ever happened?
Oh, yes. Last time that happened was in 1996 here at the mall. And we took up, oh my God, all of the mall, all the way down and into the trees.
We were going to have a big display, welcome home display at Golden Gate Park. Then COVID-19 hit. I started making masks that you could put an N95 into so that it would make their masks reusable. See, they have a pocket. Now I've been giving them, 20, 50. Every few weeks I give them a bunch. I've been giving to UCSF, the nurses there. I gave them like 80 the other day. And I try to make some fun ones, a little mustache, Then they love them because they're from the quilt. It's connected to another epidemic that was meant to help people heal. The fabric has kind of healed a lot of other people. Hopefully maybe you can do it again.
Gert McMullen, Sewing the Front Line, was produced by the Kitchen Sisters, Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson, in collaboration with Nathan Dalton. You're listening to The Keepers, archiving the now.
All right, we're going to roll. Ready?
I always start with this image of Earthrise, made on Christmas Eve, December 24th, 1968, on the first mission to go all the way out to the moon. One of the astronauts saw out of the corner of his eye this amazing image. They didn't expect it.
Oh, my God, look at that picture over there. There's the Earth coming up. Wow.
Sounds like a family on vacation in a station wagon.
Give me a roll of color quick.
Oh, man, that's great.
Quick, where's my camera? Get me some color film.
Several of them. Here,
wait a minute. Let's get the right setting here. Calm down, Bubba.
Oh, I got it right. Oh, that's a beautiful shot.
This one's called the Blue Marble, and it was from Apollo 17, the last image taken by a human being from far enough out in space to see the planet whole, the most published photograph in all of history. I do so many slideshows and presentations, I just never get nervous anymore, but I'm nervous before this one, the very first Climate Underground Conference here on Gore Farm.
Al Gore is back, and he's got a new slideshow. Better take heed. Last October, the former vice president, Nobel Prize, and Academy Award winner for An Inconvenient Truth, along with activist, restaurateur, and founder of the Edible Schoolyard, Alice Waters, gathered farmers, ranchers, scientists, soil visionaries, chefs, students, activists, and policymakers on Al's family farm in Carthage, Tennessee, to talk about the role of soil, food, and regenerative agriculture in combating the climate crisis. They called the two-day event the Climate Underground.
As a child, from first year of my life all the way through until I was in college, I spent every summer here on this farm, and every Christmas and every spring vacation. And my father taught me how to recognize the best and most fertile soil. Put my hands in it, and it was black and moist. I always believed agriculture and the food system are absolutely key to solving and mitigating the climate crisis. We have converted this farm to a whole variety of regenerative practices, a combination of plants and livestock with highly diverse cover crops and maximum use of no-till, avoiding synthetic insecticide. We harvested our first crop according to these new practices in 2016, only 3 years ago. So I'm very excited that we have not only regenerative farmers, but also scientists and entrepreneurs and chefs. We've got some really
The climate underground happened months before the moment we find ourselves in right now, as the coronavirus pandemic continues its sweep across the globe. But it holds the seeds of hope for a different approach to the land, and for the fate of the planet we all share.
So, this is our home. We've got to save it. I'll just close by referencing one of my favorite poets, Wallace Stevens. He wrote these lines: after the final no, there comes a yes. And on that yes, the future world depends. Every great morally based revolution in human history has met with an endless series of no's, until at long last the central choice is revealed as a choice between what's right and what's wrong. That is the moment the climate movement is at now. And the farmer-led regenerative agriculture movement is part and parcel of this morally based revolution. If you ever doubt that we as human beings have the ability to solve this, just remember that political will is itself a renewable resource. Thank you very much.
You can hear this whole story and the wisdom of the scientists, farmers, chefs, and soil visionaries on our podcast, The Kitchen Sisters Present. Thanks to the teams of Al Gore and Alice Waters, who together brought this summit to life and who welcomed the Kitchen Sisters and our microphones.
What made you decide to come here?
I called Alice. It's me, Alice. It's Matthew. And she goes, I'm so glad you called me today. She said, I'm getting ready to go do this conference, and I need you to help me with these greens and beans. And then she goes, you know what? I'm trying to find some garbanzo beans. I said, for what? She said, well, I really want to make hummus. And I was like, why don't you use field peas? Field peas are coming out right now. And she was like, oh, my God. That's what we're talking about, field peas. That's right. I'm in your neck of the woods. And then she goes, wait a second. You need to be at this conference because you have a 100-year-old farm. You've been doing this kind of stuff. Your family's been doing it. And I want you to communicate and talk to people about what it's like to be in the South as a chef and a farmer, African-American, talking about regenerative agriculture, sustainability. My name is Matthew Rayford. I am a chef and farmer, or chef farmer, at Gilliard Farms in Brunswick, Georgia. I'm on family land. I'm the sixth generation to be on it farming. I was raised by a father that was a baker by trade from the 50s and 60s. During his lifetime, he never saw anyone that was African-American make it to become an executive chef. So he didn't want me to cook at all. He was like, there's a lot of things you can do. Cooking ain't one of them. He said, you can go to school, do anything you want now. I just want to cook. I want to go to culinary school. My dad was like, no, you can't do it. I went in the military. When I got out, I was going to Howard University, and I was cooking all the time. Then to get into farming, we were sitting around, and my nana was like, baby, what are we going to do with all this land? And I said, Nana, we should go back to farming it. And she said, did you say we, baby? And I said, yes, ma'am. Her, my mom, and my aunt, them sisters, got together. They reached underneath the table and gift-deeded my sister and I 28 acres and was like, y'all need to get back to farming. And at the time, I was executive chef at the House of Representatives in Washington, D.C., and I'm like, I can't just leave my job. In 2011, I moved back to the farm full-time. I had the conversation with my nana about going back to school and learning about organic farming. She heard me use the word organic, and what she actually thought was chemistry. My nana goes, baby, you sit down with me for a little while. I want to know what you learned in school. So I'm telling her what I learned. She was like, no, tell me about the organic stuff. I said, that is the organic stuff. She was like, no, baby, you talking about farming. Baby, you mean to tell me your ass went all the way to California to learn what you already know how to do? So I'm telling her about compost. And she goes, oh, you talking about the honey wagon? Like, we know how to do the honey wagon, baby. We've been making manure tea since, I don't know. I mean, your great-granddaddy used to make manure tea. And I was like, oh, my God. I could have actually just given my nana the money and just sat at her feet. And I think we need to take the time to sit at the feet of our elders and actually listen, regardless of whether they're using a big scientific word or something as simple as the old ways. I mean, what I see here at Al Gore's Ranch, you know, the reclamation of land and how to do carbon sequestering, making sure that you rotate various animals through the pasture, spreading that manure out and letting that grass grow, putting things in paddocks. That's the old ways.
You're listening to The Keepers from the Kitchen Sisters and PRX. Back in a moment. Welcome back. You're listening to The Keepers, archiving the now from the Kitchen Sisters and PRX. I'm your host, Frances McDormand.
My name is Louis Jones. I'm an archivist at Wayne State University, Detroit, Michigan. We have the Walter Reuther Library of Labor and Urban Affairs. That's what we're known for, Union Records. I'm the field archivist there, and so it's essentially convinced people to give us their stuff, you know.
For 27 years, Dr. Jones has been building and caring for the largest labor archive in North America. Home to numerous union and labor collections from around the country, the Reuther Library also collects material documenting Detroit's civil rights movement, women's struggles in the workplace, the LGBTQ archive of Detroit, and more.
We have the American Federation of Teachers, the Airline Pilots Association, the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, United Auto Workers.
Have you ever asked yourselves what the UAW is?
Auto workers, aircraft workers, metal workers.
1,500,000 members.
UAW is a democratic union.
Men and women, Negro,
the largest in America, if not in the entire world.
Always liked history. That's what I studied in undergraduate school, and I studied at Morehouse doing a little research. That's where I started learning more about this thing called the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. My grandfather was a Pullman porter. Pullman porters, usually black men, sometimes Filipinos, that's fairly rare, but usually black men, and they're organized by a union called the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. And so it gave me my own personal, this is my grandfather, you know, it made history something personal, meaningful. I started learning more about this union. These things got me interested in history. So that's kind of how I got into this whole crazy business.
The grandson of a Pullman porter, Jones thinks deeply about how archivists are reimagining their roles as collectors and preservationists in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic, the Black Lives Matter movement, and the dismantling of historical monuments across America.
I'm from New York City originally. There's a statue of Theodore Roosevelt in front of the Museum of Natural History, not even a full mile from where I grew up. A Native American on one side and African American on another side, and he's riding on a horse triumphantly. And I always looked at that as a kid and thought, boy, that's not really right. That's going to be taken down now. They should just go. That's my opinion. They are historical documents, though, right? They're objects that they perhaps have a place in a museum that puts them in context, that doesn't glorify them. These are discussions I think are really important to have. And more than discussions, I think, let's just do it. It's a good thing to do. I mean, it's just like a constant reminder of this racist refrain.
Louis Jones is archiving the now.
One of the things that we're doing in terms of COVID-19, and we have something that allows anybody to upload. It could be a photo, it could be a video, it could be a blog post that will become part of our collection documenting this particular moment. There's some collections that we want to make available online that reflects a lot of the sentiments that we're seeing today after the cruel and brutal murder of George Floyd and of others, Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery. It's a big difference now. the protests in Detroit in the spring and summer of 2020. It's a lot younger people. It's very interracial. This is a new generation demonstrating and making their voices and their presence known, desiring change. Because I'm the field archivist, how I see my job changing, I kind of see myself out with some of these protests in the months to come, with a mask on, maybe from some distance, taking pictures. I can see myself getting involved to make sure that this moment is documented. Let's just do it.
You're listening to The Keepers from the Kitchen Sisters and PRX, stories of grit, hope, possibility. I'm your host, Frances McDormand.
Akilah.
My name is Kerry O'Sullivan, 18 years old.
Azaria.
I flew from Dublin into JFK and then JFK to San Juan.
Destiny. I'm Nabila Abbas. I'm a social activist from Pakistan.
Picture this. 137 people, 13 to 26 years old, from 37 countries.
My name is Salvador Gomez Colon. It's really nice to be here to have 126 youth come together so we can make some real change in the world.
Youth activists from around the globe.
Matilda Bandedunsbo. I'm 15 years old from Denmark. People call me Climate Chick at my school.
All gathered together in San Juan, Puerto Rico in August 2019, the week after the scandal-ridden government of Governor Ricardo Rossello fell, brought down in large measure because of the resolve and activism of young people across the Hurricane Maria battered island.
Puerto Ricans are frustrated about corruption, the debt crisis, and a slow recovery following Hurricane Maria. They're also upset about leaked chat messages where the governor had made sexist and homophobic remarks and mocked constituents, including those who died during Hurricane Maria.
This wasn't part of the plan for the second meeting of the International Congress of Youth Voices. It was pure coincidence. But here they all are, coming from across the planet, jet-lagged and lit from within, to learn from one another and an array of artists, writers, and activists, to tell their stories and to build a global network of young visionaries from around the world.
It's a bizarre thing to turn on, you know, your phone, go on Twitter, and see millions of people in the streets of Puerto Rico and then have it register that I'm about to be there.
My name is Harris Hosseini. I'm 18 years old. To have an International Congress of Youth Activists and Writers and Speakers come together at right now what might be in the world, this epicenter of peaceful protest and of the power of the people. You know, I cannot think of a better place to have it.
The Kitchen Sisters present Youth on Fire, the International Congress of Youth Voices.
My name is Yasmin Jabber. I am 16 years old and I live in Chesterfield, Virginia. This is my first year here. It's a Congress of Youth trying to make change in their communities and like the entire world. We create a manifesto of what we're trying to get done and what our values are, and then hopefully throughout the year, get it done. I do love talking about things. I'll talk about social justice all day, every day, but then, you know, I wouldn't have any friends. So I had to create kind of a outlet for that. So I have a podcast.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Was It Something I Said? I'm your host, Yasmin. It's been 2 months since my last podcast, but today I'm going to be talking about mass shootings in America. There have been 307.
My name is Dave Eggers, one of the staffers for the International Congress of Youth Voices. We started this writing center in San Francisco called 826 Valencia, and I used to teach high school students there. And then when 826 spawned dozens of other centers like it around the world, Stockholm, Melbourne, or Santiago, I would meet their writers, and we would put anthologies of their writing together over the years, but they never really got to meet. And I kept thinking, Zainab, who I met in Copenhagen, could meet Gilda here in San Francisco, and they all had an activist spirit, and they might be able to sort of really dream up great things together.
My name is Zainab Nasrati. I am 23. I am a medical student. I got together with a group of youngsters, and we started a radio station, a Radio Y in Copenhagen. The Y because we want to ask questions. because media ain't always doing that rightfully.
And then they got to start an open mic. They got to hear from each other. And some of the students were spoken word performers. The Russian delegate read Pushkin in English and Russian.
Александр Пушкин. Духовной жаждою томим, в пустыне мрачной я влачился, и шестикрылый Серафим на перепутье мне явился.
My spirit was athirst for grace, I wandered in a darkened land, and at the crossing of the ways beheld a six-winged seraph stand.
My name is Serafima Masintsova. I'm 19 years old and I'm from St. Petersburg, part of the International Union of Writers in Russia. There was an open mic and I decided to read Pushkin's poetry because I think people around were presenting their art and I decided that we should also have some background from the countries we are going from. Presenting Pushkin is like representing Russia in some way. It was the poem called Prophet, about how people sometimes are lost in the world, but then something comes to their mind and they realize that they have something to do in the world.
My name is Itumeleng Khosikhadia Khabanda. I'm a 21-year-old female and I come from Alexandra Township in the north of Johannesburg in South Africa. I come from a community and a township where you walk outside and there's no hope at all. I was born into a family of white people. My mother was a domestic worker. They were her white employers, so she was an employee. I was raised by these white people. I was in preschool. There was a day where I was going out to school. I was waiting for the driver to come collect me, and the thugs came in. They used duct tape to tie us up. Even in the main house, the employers were also tied up. My sister was crying, my mom was crying. They asked for the safe, and my mother said she doesn't know where the safe is. My mother just pleaded with them, if you're gonna do anything, just don't hurt my children. They said she was talking too much, and the guy took the back of the gun and slammed her across the head. She spent several months in hospital. We didn't think she was gonna make it, but she did make it. The white people are like, we can't stay in South Africa anymore, we're moving to Australia. So for me, when I heard those news, I was excited because I'm like, I'm leaving because they were my family. But that wasn't the case, that they were leaving and I was staying in South Africa. We moved into a one room house. I'm so used to having my own space. I'm so used to showering in the morning and now I need to bath in a dish. My mother, with every little cent she had, she put everything into my education. I don't want the next generation to worry about if they're going to be safe on the roads, will they make it back home? I need to be the voice of those people who have experienced gun violence. Something needs to be done, something can be done. It won't happen overnight, but eventually if we stand together and we talk about it, maybe your story can provide healing to someone else's on the other side.
My name is Felicia Wong, Programs Manager for the International Congress of Youth Voices. I spent countless hours last year just Googling youth activists Nepal, youth activists Bangalore, youth activists Haiti. Then I would find them on Facebook or on Instagram and contact them and invite them to apply.
Soy diferente.
I'm Precious Perez, I'm 21 and I'm from Boston. I'm studying music education and performance at Berklee College of Music in Boston. My goal is to use my platform as a singer-songwriter to represent all of the communities I'm a part of. For example, I'm blind, I'm Puerto Rican, I'm a woman, I have anxiety from low income, so like all these different communities. And I want to use my platform to give those people a voice.
As a blind person, you are an activist. When you're walking down the street and you go and you pick up Taco Bell, like, people in the background are going, holy shit, that blind guy just bought a taco, like, how did he do that? That's crazy. All throughout our lives, we're representing our community, and we are the face of people's perceptions of blind people.
I'm Shane Lowe, and I'm 19 years old from Louisville, Kentucky. I'm a musician, I play percussion for Precious.
We met online 6 years ago. She studied in Valencia and of course started the career at Berklee. We are engaged.
My name is Freshta and I'm from Kabul, Afghanistan.
Freshta Torejan One of her many reasons for applying for this was I was a religious minority in Afghanistan. My family has been persecuted for their beliefs. I had to run. I'm here to tell the world my story so this doesn't happen again.
I left home 4.5 years ago when the Taliban shut down my school. The government was after my family for so long. In order for us to survive, like, we all had to live separately, so in case one of us get caught, then the rest of us can survive. I got into boarding school in Texas, got a scholarship there. It was too dangerous for me to go home, and my mom couldn't have me there.
The Taliban took in my dad.
I had, like, really strong PTSD, and throughout high school I had forgotten a lot of things from my childhood. Like, I got so much therapy, and that's just starting to work, so my memory's finally starting to come back. Right now I live in Michigan, and there's this whole, you know, the Flint water crisis. There's lead in the water, children are, like, facing a lot of horrible health issues. So I'll be working on a project with some of them of how we can get the governors, the legislators, to actually pay attention to those areas. I've really enjoyed networking with all of these leaders. This is the first time where I've actually seen youth not scared to speak up. And some of us have even, like, started talking about getting together to work on future projects. And it's just such an honor to be with these people. Like, I can already see them be presidents of countries, governors, and the UN all over the place. Like, we hold the world. And I think this is where, like, I really saw that vision coming to life.
Ronnie Vallarta, I'm 19 years old.
What I love was everybody's story and everybody's willingness to be vulnerable. Not only do you want to be heard, but everybody around you wants to hear you. And it's almost like a high that you get because not everybody hears you all the time, especially with teenagers. A lot of people are like, well, they're young and they have a bunch of time. Really, we don't have a lot of time. We are all affected by one another, and I love how everybody here affects everyone in a positive direction.
Youth on Fire, the International Congress of Youth Voices, was produced by the Kitchen Sisters in collaboration with Teddy Alexander and Rachel Templeton. There's more about this remarkable group and their photographs on our social media series at Kitchen Sisters, hashtag Youth on Fire. The Keepers, Archiving the Now, is produced by the Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, in collaboration with Nathan Dalton and Brandy Howell, and interns Aaliyah Renee Yates, Teddy Alexander, Jonathan Shea, Matt Hoish, and Paulina Hartano, and mixed by Jim McKee. As the writer Terry Tempest Williams says, collaboration is the only way forward. Funding for the Keepers comes from PRX, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the National Endowment for the Arts, Art Works, the Robert Sillins Family Foundation, the Kalita A. Doolin Foundation, Bowling with Grace, and listener contributions to the Kitchen Sisters Productions. The Kitchen Sisters Present is part of the Radiotopia Podcast Network from PRX, a collective of independent, distinct, and beautifully crafted podcasts full of stories that expand your world. You can see the AIDS quilt and Gert's homemade masks on our website, kitchensisters.org. Want to hear more stories? There are tons on our podcast, The Kitchen Sisters Present. Thanks for listening. I'm Frances McDormand. Keep it steady now.